Welcome back. It's a Tuesday, the 6th day of November, 2018, and yeah, you know what that means. I'm your host, Mark Call, and it also means that most of the news is focused on that singularly important event, and that even if there was a false flag event today, since it's probably too late to influence the election anyway, most of the waystream press isn't likely to pay any attention to it. Later on in the week, however, is by far a different story, especially if their planned blue wave continues to implode. So let's start with a story that all of us knew was coming, since in the land of the feckless, the Constitution and Bill of Rights obviously isn't worth the paper it's printed on, and a number of beta tests to prove just how far and how fast they can go in that direction are underway. And in this case, I'm talking about the various gun confiscation beta tests. From multiple sources, including local Baltimore area TV and newspapers, police in the progressive wannabe gun-free killing zone of Maryland shot and killed a man in his own home on Monday while serving a so-called protective order. I bet he felt real protected. Under a new, they still call it a law, folks. When it's a violation of the Constitution, it isn't, but most people don't know that anymore, which allowed them, at least to claim, to seize people's guns without the need for any stinking due process. So this now marks the first reported casualty in the escalating attempt at gun confiscation in formerly free America, says the Baltimore Sun birdcage liner. Two Anne Arundel County police officers, sick, served one of the new red flag protection orders to remove guns from a house, and then in the process killed a Ferndale man after he resisted that theft and a struggle ensued. The subject of the protective order, Gary J. Willis, age 60, answered his door in the 100 block of Linwood Avenue at 5:17 a.m. in the morning with a gun in his hand, said Anne Arundel County Police. He initially put that gun down next to the door but became irate when the so-called officers began to serve him with the unconstitutional totalitarian order. And when he picked up the gun, one of the thugs struggled with him to take it while the other fatally shot Willis. So yeah, folks, welcome to America with a K, and something that a lot of leftists just a few years back said, don't worry, this could never happen in America. Neither, of course, could the destruction of the rest of the Bill of Rights. And Chris Menahan of Information Liberation points out that since the new gun confiscation law went into effect on October 1st, so-called police acting under color of law have carried out 19 such confiscation orders, which comes out to around one seizure every other day. And at this rate, that comes out to about one murder a month. But if things go according to the Hitlerian plan here, that will no doubt accelerate. And given that this is Election Day, folks, I think you'll see now why it is that I started off with that particularly disgusting and hopefully eye-opening story. Because all across the nation, elected officials and, supposedly at least, police officers are required to take an oath supporting both the Constitution for these United States and the state where they're supposedly serving the people. And by now, those of you who've listened to this particular show know that your host has a real problem with people who put their hand on the Bible, take an oath, and lie through their teeth. And when people violate that oath, and yeah, let's just be blunt here, commit acts of war against the very people that they were supposed to protect and serve, what then? I think we're seeing the what then part play out right now. We saw it in Nazi Germany, we saw it in Soviet Russia, and now we're seeing it play out in the Soviet states of America. Shall not be infringed is pretty clear. And furthermore, there's no pretense of so-called due process with these red flag orders. They did, however, turn out to work really well in Soviet Russia. You just declare somebody insane, and then you can do anything you want with them. You just declare anybody who doesn't follow the party line, literally, to be mentally suspect, and therefore you can do anything you want with them. Starting with taking away their right to defend themselves against exactly what you intend to do to them. And let me interject this here as well. Occasionally I get questions from listeners, why do you sometimes say the word sick, it's spelled S-I-C, after reading certain parts of some articles? Like in this case, when I quoted this story about two so-called police officers, sick, who served an unconstitutional red flag protective order on somebody they were supposed to protect and serve, and ended up killing him instead. Well, the word sick is inserted when somebody's quoting something that they know is just plain wrong, because in fact, these aren't police officers, because they were acting under what is called color of law, meaning looks like but isn't. In other words, they may have a uniform, a badge, and a gun, but when they're violating their sworn oath as a sworn police officer, they're acting under color of law, and they're not really officers. They're thugs, they're thieves, and in this case, murderers. Which may go some ways toward explaining why they do these heinous things at just after 5 a.m. in the morning, or in some cases, even earlier, for reasons thugs have long understood. And I'll go one step further here, folks. You ever heard the expression, ignorance of the law is no excuse? Your host will suggest that every single one of these thugs serving these red flag orders has heard that expression, and that furthermore, every single one of these feckless oath breakers who's violating their oath before God and the people that they chose to serve has never read, honestly, the constitutions of their state or these United States that clearly, unequivocally prohibit exactly what they're doing. Because otherwise, obviously, they would have refused to violate the law, especially if they know that ignorance of the law is no excuse, and that, quote, an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose. Its unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment, and not merely the date of the decision so branding it. An unconstitutional law, in legal contemplation, is as inoperative as if it had never been passed. And furthermore, since an unconstitutional law is void, the general principles follow that it imposes no duties, confers no rights, creates no office, bestows no power or authority on anyone, and that would include people acting under color of law and committing acts of theft and murder, affords no protection, and justifies no acts performed under it. Unquote. And if you're curious, folks, that comes from a couple of places, including an 1886 court case called Norton v. Shelby County, 118 U.S. 425, and, of course, the legal volumes known collectively as AmJur, for American Jurisprudence. In this case, 16 AmJur 2nd, Section 177, Late 2D, Section 256. And any police officer that doesn't understand that not only ought to turn in his badge, but has no business carrying a gun. And you know what, folks? On this election day, I guess it's important to remind people, maybe that's why, back when we had a rule of law, people who were supposed to enforce it, and especially claim the delegated authority to make it, were required to take an oath. So let me ask a rhetorical question as we talk about the rest of the news on this election day, 2018. If 51% of the people in some area vote to take away the life, liberty, and property of the other 49% and kill them if they object, is there still law? So let's kick it off with this Harbinger story from the markets and Zero Hedge. Ahead of the most important day for U.S. politics in years, they write, global markets have hunkered down, coiling in anticipation or dipping cautiously into the red as traders brace for midterm elections in the United States while anticipating a shock outcome, what with 2016 still fresh in everyone's mind. Which your host thought was an interesting way to phrase it, almost like traders are beginning to realize, especially when it comes to the American wannabe Bolshevik Revolution, that the waste-stream media lies. Imagine that. A quick case in point, from the socialist media platforms, and in particular to Facebook, they just took down a website called Fellowship of the Minds, right in time for the November 6th midterm election. You can probably guess whether they're for or again the deep state swamp. And that brings the total of high-profile sites that Big Brother doesn't want you to be able to read ever closer to the four-figure mark. And we do have this for a bit of comic relief from the top trader, the fellow who's famous for his oath-breaking nationwide, even if the left won't admit it, former CIA chief-turned-Twitter troll John Brennan, who, as the Gateway Pundit put it, begged people to vote to defeat the Trump-supporting candidates in the midterms so that he doesn't have to go to jail. And from the American Spectator, some interesting and even good news about real bridge building, this time in Montana. Did you ever wonder, begins the piece, how Senator John Tester, a Beltway swamp creature who voted against the confirmation of Kavanaugh and famously stays in lockstep with his fellow socialists when it comes to immigration and gun control, keeps managing to get elected in a state like Montana? The answer is simple. The Libertarian Party usually nominates a spoiler who siphons just enough votes from Tester's GOP challengers so that he wins by the skin of his teeth. Back in 2012, for example, Libertarian Dan Cox garnered just enough of the vote to allow Tester to eke out a narrow 4% win. This year, though, was no different, up until last week, when Libertarian Rick Breckinridge decided to endorse Republican Matt Rosendale, The Libertarian had been pulling enough support in the polls to enable Tester to slither back into the swamp again. So why did Breckinridge throw his support to Rosendale? As the AP puts it, the Libertarian candidate threw his surprise support behind his Republican opponent last week in response to an election mailer from an unknown group that appeared aimed at undermining Rosendale's support among conservatives. And, reports the AP, a similar tactic was used in Tester's last re-election bid, and this kind of outside interference in Montana's election process appears to have been just as offensive to the Libertarian candidate as it was to Rosendale himself, who said the mailer appeared to be an attempt by so-called dark money groups to influence Montana's election. And furthermore, says the American Spectator, this isn't Tester's only PR problem, because he sent out mailers to voters suggesting he was an avid hunter. But that lie has now been revealed, too. Turns out he hasn't had a hunting license in years, which not only damaged Tester's credibility, but made him the butt of more than one joke. Donald Trump Jr. recently quipped, "That senator won't hunt." And as hopefully soon Senator-elect Rosendale pointed out, all of this is indicative of Tester's transformation into a swamp creature. Quote, "John Tester has become everything he ran against 12 years ago." So, folks, if there's an underlying theme that we'll probably watch play out today, it's that the progressive, oath-breaking liars aren't even trying to hide what they are anymore. More and more Americans are seeing through it, and we'll see whether that's enough or not. There are, of course, no shortage of analyses and pollster predictions and stories about which races to watch. Most of the honest sources seem to be admitting that if there's not a blue wave, and don't expect one, the final results, especially for the House, could take days or even weeks to come out as mail-in ballots, especially from illegals in places like California that may take a while to come in, are counted. And yeah, I'm going to put the word sick after that, if you remember what that famous progressive Joe Stalin once said. So here are 9 races, 3 each for the House, Senate, and governorships, that are said to be key. In Indiana, there's the incumbent Democrat Joe Donnelly, who pretends not to be one, running against intended usurper Mike Braun. In Florida, of course, you have incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson defending his seat against the Republican current governor, Rick Scott. In a race where neither of the swamp critters can claim constitutional fealty, Governor Rick Scott, of course, recently signed Florida's absolutely unconstitutional Second Amendment gang-raping red flag law. But maybe he's changed. And there's always the lesser of two evils claim to remember, right? Which brings us to Arizona, where the outgoing, aptly named Senator Flake gave new meaning to the term and opted to retire rather than lose a primary, even though the seat he infested once belonged to one of the most infamous rhinos and turncoats in the entire Senate, John McCain. So in one major sense, folks, the worst that can happen in Arizona is basically no change. Although the leftist Democrat running there, Kyrsten Sinema, would arguably immediately become one of the worst outright communists in the District of Criminal Swamp. Her opponent is Martha McSally, a former Air Force fighter pilot who's currently a representative for a moderate district in Tucson. And since the left really wants to hang on to this one, it'll certainly be interesting to watch. In the House, there's Virginia's 7th Congressional District, which pits incumbent Republican David Bratt against Democrat Abigail Spanberger. And interestingly, Nothing But Communist News calls Bratt an early adopter of the brand of identity politics that now define the GOP in the Trump era. I can't help but notice they don't say anything even remotely similar about the socialist or their brand of politically correct racism that now defines the anti-rule-of-law progressives in that same Trump era. So having pointed that out, I'll give NBC their final jab for today. This race, they claim, is seen as a bellwether for whether college-educated suburban voters, especially what they call Panera moms, who traditionally vote Republican, probably because they don't know any better and haven't been enlightened by the likes of NBC or the WAPO, will repudiate Trump and his brand of politics by voting Democratic or staying home. And do you see what I mean? There's Kentucky's 6th Congressional District, which is called one of the most competitive and expensive races in the country, and pits third-term Republican Andy Barr against Democrat Amy McGrath. The claim is that polls are deadlocked. You probably already have a pretty good inkling of what that means. Which brings me back to Florida and the 27th Congressional District, pitting Republican candidate Maria Elvira Salazar against socialist and Clinton regime health secretary, sick, Donna Shalala. This seat was held by a retiring Republican, but the stories point out that this congressional district was won by Hitler in 2016, who campaigned for her fellow scumbag. And all of this does lead some cynics, like your host, to wonder whether or not the election rigging in that district might still be in place. And let's stay in Florida for the governor's race, where former congressional representative, Republican Ron DeSantis, is hoping to ride President Donald Trump's backing to victory in the governor's race over one of the worst socialists, and this is saying a lot, this year, in the entire country. The unindicted, but certainly questionable, Andrew Gillum, who even the WAPO admits is an unabashed liberal. And then there's Georgia, where Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp, who embraces Trump, is running against the leftist gun banner, but hey, aren't they all, where the main issue seems to be, so far as the fake news is concerned, whether Georgia will select the nation's first African-American female governor. Some of us might suggest whether Georgians intend to remain free might be a more important issue. And interestingly, say the poll watchers, there's a little-noticed third-party campaign of Libertarian Ted Metz to consider if he gets enough votes to prevent either Abrams or Kemp from surpassing 50% under Georgia's election law. Kind of wonder if that really matters anymore if it doesn't turn out right. There would be a runoff election on December 4th, extending the campaign for nearly another month. And maybe, just maybe, that might be a good enough reason for Georgia's Libertarians to vote against outright tyranny. Lastly, there's Kansas, which is said to be a reliable state for Republicans. Trump bested Hillary here by 21 points in the 2016 election. But the Republican Secretary of State Kris Kobach is facing a tough campaign against longtime state senator Laura Kelly in an attempt to fill the position vacated by Governor Sam Brownback when Trump selected him to serve in the administration. Zero Hedge's summary in a pretty lengthy piece says that Democrats, of course, need to achieve a net gain of 23 seats in order to take over the House of Representatives, and then, of course, immediately begin impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump. And depending upon whose polls you believe, when it comes to what are called the toss-up races, say most pollsters, the Socialists would need to win at least 8 of those to cement a progressive takeover of the House. Notably, notes Zero Hedge, the only major polling company projecting Republicans will retain control of the lower chamber is Rasmussen Reports, which was also the only major polling firm to correctly call the 2016 election for Donald Trump. Why, concludes Tyler Durden, even the notorious pollster Nate Silver, who was notoriously wrong in 2016, but has been saying that a Democrat-controlled House is a lead pipe cinch, has been backing off of late. The man who had been saying, yeah, an 87.4% chance that the Democrats win the House, over the weekend said, well, Democrats have a 4-in-5 chance of winning, which at least sounds more statistically credible. But then he went on to say, quote, polls aren't always right, and the Democrats might only win 19 seats, or maybe they could win 51. Both of those are, quote, extremely possible, unquote. And how's that for weaseling out? Well, as the cynics at Zero Hedge, writing as Tyler Durden put it, one thing's for sure, somebody is going to win on Tuesday. And as your host again adds, the big question is, will that be the people who actually got the most votes? And maybe I should even say legal votes, since it may end up not mattering all that much longer. And that's arguably an especially poignant observation if you remember what happened to Donald Trump's attempt at an election commission to look into real vote tampering prior to 2016. And how it was stonewalled by some of the very same states that are considered battlegrounds today, for what your host will suggest is an obvious reason. There's also no shortage today of op-ed pieces purporting to examine the potential outcomes of the election. We can certainly ignore, for now, the whining of the progressive waste stream, but as more than one wag has pointed out, if they don't get their way, the bedwetting will come tomorrow, while the violence may be on tap either way. I did think this look at Europe was interesting. Zero Hedge points out that a site called Gefira, which purports to provide global analysis from the European perspective, is now warning the Italian people they need to understand that their country is at war. The conflict that begins between the European Union and Italy is a full-blown financial war. Euro countries cannot print their own money, and for that reason they cannot have an endless deficit. Countries within the Eurozone have to live within their means, or else, yeah, sure, without the intervention of the European Central Bank, they will go bankrupt. Nobody knows, it says, the consequences of an Italian default and debt restructuring, but it could lead to the end of the euro. Booga, booga, booga. So concerning the big and current budget battle, the deputy prime minister wrote that this is the first Italian budget written in Rome, their capital, and not in Brussels, whereupon Matteo Salvini added, this rejection of their budget by the EU doesn't change anything. Quote, they're not attacking a government, but a people. These are things that will anger Italians even more, unquote. So, suggests Gaffira, and I think they may be onto something, to force the Prime Minister and Matteo Salvini out of office, the European Union will go to any lengths necessary to destroy the Italian banking sector. The same way they did it to Greece, and before that, to Cyprus. Concludes the Gaffira piece, the general public there is unaware of the seriousness of the situation, because both Salvini and Matteo, as well as the Italian people, need to realize that they're at war with the European establishment, which ultimately intends to remove them from power. Need I say it? By any means necessary. And if that sounds familiar on this election day, folks, maybe it should. I want to spend a few minutes next on an article from Daisy Luther, the organic prepper. This seems especially apropos on this day and during this week, because it asks a timely question. Are you prepared for lockdown, she says, how to stay safe when all hell breaks loose in America? Yes, it begins. Tensions are incredibly high in the United States right now. I realize that over the past 3 years, I've written that they're at an all-time high far too many times, so I'll just say now they're high enough that all hell could break loose at any moment, given the right or wrong application of fuel to the fire. And yes, she notes, pretending it isn't happening is not a rational response to the chaos that's coming. People, especially those near the border, are concerned about what might happen if thousands of immigrants push through illegally, while even those in other parts of the country are concerned about the aftermath of whatever happens when those people arrive at the border, and as your host has suggested, especially if the planned events come to pass. So given the midterms, the economy, and all the other things that are so clearly coming to a head, the threat of civil unrest, to put it mildly, is high. So given all of that, just how prepared are you really? If you had to go into lockdown mode, she suggests, and keep your family safely at home, how long would you last with the supplies you currently have on hand? If the answer is either a few days or a couple of weeks, you'd better work on that immediately. Because by planning ahead, she writes, we can avoid the fear, panic, and confusion that leads people to rush to the store and clear the shelves like a horde of hungry locusts. We can stay away from the angry masses, the rioters who'll use any excuse to steal, and the hungry people determined to feed their kids no matter who stands in their way. So whether or not violent protests over the next few weeks lead to some kind of pandemonium, provoking some type of martial law, a prepared mindset, a defense plan, and a well-stocked home can certainly help keep you and your family out of harm's way. And bear in mind, she says, it may not be entirely in your hands. Remember Boston, where people were forced to stay in their homes, a.k.a., and you'll no doubt hear this again, shelter in place. Now, step one, and I won't spend a lot of time on this one, although she does, is if you're caught away from home when violence erupts, you better be able to get there. It's step two that we'll focus on in the brief time remaining. Preparing for that lockdown. And I say that because the last few steps are hopefully more obvious, like trying to stay under the radar, be prepared to defend your family, and that's, of course, in part what so many progressives are trying to prevent, given that they know what they're planning. And if chaos does come to your neighborhood, hopefully you'll be in a place where it won't, but even so, stay inside and don't participate. Which leads me to the list of minimums. Hopefully most of these you've thought through, but maybe some you haven't, and now's the time. Number one, water, of course, necessary prescriptions, if you're taking those. A well-stocked pantry ought to include at least a one-month supply of food for the entire family, including pets, but hopefully more than that. A means of cooking it off-grid, like an outdoor burner, fire pit, or wood stove, or food that doesn't require cooking. Obviously, a quality first aid kit and lighting in the event of a power outage. Don't forget sanitation supplies, especially if the power grid goes down. Some way to stay warm, especially now in winter. And things like a diverse survival guide, preparedness books, and first aid manuals, as well as alternative means of communication, like either a hand crank radio, or better still, things like ham radio. And lastly, but perhaps not leastly, some way to keep everyone entertained when the iPhones quit working, like puzzles, games, and even books. Yeah, there's of course a lot more to be considered, but given what we're seeing play out, the time to think about these things is now. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.